Welcome to Headlines. This is David Lichtenstein with an hour of learning Hashkafa Halacha. This week it's been Kesel Asar, between the week between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and the business of this week is tshuva. Now they say somebody came to the Sfasemis and he said it was during the week of Aseres Yemei Tshuva, and he had an urgent matter. He said, "I need, you know, the Chassidim go to the Rebbe with every problem. I have an urgent business matter." So the Sfasemis looked at him and he said, "This week there's only one business, the business of tshuva. I want to speak about the first vidui in the Torah, and I want to say, Avol Ashemim Anachnu. We are guilty. As a community, I think that we have to accept some guilt. And what guilt do we have to accept? This year, according to Tzvi Glock, there were close to 130 suicides, overdoses, suicides in our community. And according to Rabbi Horowitz, Rabbi Yaakov Horowitz, who we had on the radio, he says the vast majority of them are children who were molested at some point during their formative years. He says it's 90%+. Spiegelock says, I don't know, but it's a very big percentage. And there's a deafening silence. Well, it's becoming a little bit more, people are speaking about it more, a little bit more, but it's really a lot of silence, a lot of cover-up, a lot of shame, a lot of, oh my goodness, if we say something, it could ruin the life of the alleged perpetrator. And I want to say, Avol Ashemim Anachnu. We are guilty. And let me tell you an insight into it. You know, and we're going to have a number of guests tonight to talk about a number of children who didn't commit suicide, those who survived, and they're going to talk about the experience. Do you know that the first vidui in the Torah, where we learn the Lashon HaVidui out, is when Reuven, or what the brother is talking about after Yosef catches them, it says, Vayomru ish el achiv, Avol Ashemim Anachto. Targum says, Avol, what does Avol mean? Bekushta, truly, we are guilty. Alachinu and our brother, Asherinu tsaras nafshei, we saw the pain of his soul. Bishananai aleinu, when he pleaded with us, he cried, he pleaded, he implored, he impugned us, right? V'loi shamanu, and we didn't hear. So the Ramban asks the question. Ramban says, in the entire Mechiras Yosef, we don't see that Yosef opened his mouth even once. He didn't cry. He didn't impugn. He didn't plead. What are you saying? Bishananai aleinu. Ramban tries to give these struggles. He says, maybe the Torah was chas on the covet of the Shvatim. And I want to suggest a different answer. I want to say we're going to have on the radio tonight a girl from Cleveland whose brother raped her for a period of 4 years when she was a young child. And she's going to talk about how she was in such shock that an older brother could do this to her. She could never say a word. She was struck silent. She was speechless. We're going to have a number of victims, two females and one male, who say they never opened their mouth. It was a person of authority, somebody much older. They didn't say a word. And I would like to suggest a teret to the Ramban's kasha. Yosef, these were his older brothers. And you know what? It says that they were mitzaref the shechina to their bezdin. And Yosef is looking at this and he's saying, it's a terrible thing they're doing to me inside. His eyes are looking in horror, but he can't say anything. I mean, they must be right. They're older than him. They're figures of authority. Often the molester is an uncle, a father very often, a teacher, somebody older, a friend, older neighbor. The child is in shock. And what does the Torah say about it? He didn't say a word. But didn't you see his eyes? Didn't we see that friend, child, neighbor, didn't we see that suddenly their behavior changed? the outgoing child suddenly became introverted. Suddenly they started hanging out and smoking. The good student suddenly wasn't a good student. We're going to hear from a girl in Australia who was molested by this Malka Leifer, Shem Rishoy Mirkov, who molested, I think she said, you know, a dozen girls, 73 counts, and then she was smuggled by a bunch of, you know, really, they say the road to heaven is paved with, the road to Gehenim is paved with goodwill. A bunch of the community smuggled the molester out so she shouldn't have to face charges, astonishingly. These people have to answer. Look at the pain that was caused. Where were we? Do you know that there are three types of tefillahs we find? There's the tefillah of the tefillah bepeh, the tefillah that's brought into Shulchan Aruch that we have to hear it. You have to be mitzi misfasav, right? Even if it's not nishma, but it has to be uttered from the mouth. The lips have to whisper the tefillah. And then there's a different type of tefillah, the tefillah shofar. It's just a cry, a tzaka. Right? There's a fabulous verse from Rav Futna. Rav Futna said, he says, Mordechai, vayitzak tz'aka gedailo umaris. Rav Futna said, why did he cry? What did he scream? So Rav Futna said, they used to say, before the Anshei Knesset Gedol, the Nevi'im said, you say, hakel hagadol agibar v'hanoira. But then we were mavatal it. We said, ayeg v'raisav, at the time of the Churban, there is no more gvura. And post Mordechai, the Anshei Knesset Hagdola, they put it back in. They said, hein kuraisav. So he said, in the times of Mordechai, there was no words. Okay, la gadol gibaneris. Rav Putna said, ich kenish davenin a b'shayin vesich v'yazai. He's like, I don't know how to daven anymore, but I know how to cry. That's the sound of the shofar. It's the cry. But there's a deeper cry, deeper. Like we say in Echa, Tzoak Liba Mel Hashem. And what is that? That's the unuttered cry. And we have so many unuttered cries in our community. The cries of the molested children, the cries of children who go on drugs, the cries of children who in school, they don't fit in and they end up, we've had so many suicides, we'll have stories of that too. We have the cries of the older singles that are too ashamed to cry. There's something obviously wrong with them if they're not married. If the right person didn't come along, they never had a parent maybe who looked hard enough for them, etc., and they weren't red shidduchim, they had an older sister, an older brother, they don't cry. They're mute. They become mute silent. But there is the tefillah, the silent tefillah of Tzak Liba Mel Hashem. What do we say? We say by davening, Yu L'Ratzein Imre Fi. That's one tefillah, but there's another tefillah, deeper tefillah, the Hegyon Libi Lefanecha. And these singles, they're all crying. These boys, these children that are molested, they're all crying. And you see the first vidyas, why didn't we hear that silent cry? And you know that we say in Slichas, Misha Ana Lavram Bahara Maria Hu Yanenu. We find no tefillah of Avram Bahara Maria. Mishana liYitzchak. Yitzchak, where do we see that he was in a spell? But the Medrash says that when he lifted the knife to Shecht Yitzchak, two tears rolled down from the eyes of Avram. And they fell into Yitzchak's eyes. Some say they blinded him. But two tears. And you know what those two tears were? Those were the silent cry of Avram. We say, Mishana l'Avram b'har Meria, Hu yanu. Where are we when these singles are crying? Listen to this girl who was, for 4 years, her home became a place, her sanctuary became a place of pure pain. Mendy Klein, a tzaddik from Cleveland, who has made this his desire, he said, I will wipe, he's trying to eliminate all these suicides, reduce the suicides. He brought her to speak in Cleveland. He had the courage to do it. Many people didn't want. He did an asifa. Listen to what she says here.
At first, I froze. I had no idea what to do. I was not used to arguing against Bensi. I thought I needed his love, but this didn't seem normal. Brothers and sisters don't do this. We don't touch each other over here. I tried to wiggle at Lee. He was bigger. He was stronger. I couldn't escape. There were some times that I tried to fight back. I cried. I begged. I pleaded. But he told me that if I ever told anyone, he would tell them that I'm lying and I'm crazy. And so I believed him. After all, he was my big brother. He knew what he was talking about. Once the abuse started, it was like a light was shut off, and in its place was darkness. My entire disposition changed. I was extremely anxious and scared. What does a child do with a secret so large? What does a little girl do when her safe haven, her home, becomes the place of her very worst nightmare? I could no longer sleep peacefully at night without the fear of him intruding. And this fear was real. I was living a life of constant terror. I became withdrawn and could no longer share freely with others. I had a guard up, one of shame and fear. The love that I had for everyone turned into anger. I no longer brought sunshine into others' lives, but instead I bring rage and animosity. I had no idea what to do with all these unknown emotions and ideas. I remember that I would see my brother and just start hitting him. And he would whisper to me, "See, now if you tell them, they definitely won't believe you. They know you're crazy." And that would only make me more and more upset. In school, I turned into the class clown, the jokester. I thought if anyone ever finds out my secrets, they will think I'm disgusting, and no one will ever like me or want to be my friend. For years, I was ashamed and anxious. I never thought I could be accepted for who I truly was. I always felt like I was standing on the outside and alone. And while I can stand tall and say I'm a survivor, and I would not trade my past for an easier one, I still feel the shame of incest today. I have found my place, and I have friends. But I wonder, as I stand here speaking in front of people who have come specifically to support survivors like me, will they still accept me after knowing all this about me? It's not easy to let go of the shame. I just need to remember that I did nothing wrong and to walk through these feelings until I find courage at the other end. When I was little, I couldn't tell my parents because I didn't think they would believe me. He said he would tell everyone I was crazy, and he knew everything. But I also knew how wrong it was what he was doing, and I didn't want to hurt them. In my young mind, I couldn't see how much it was destroying me, and I didn't want my parents in pain from the actions of their children. But abuse is never a family matter. How can we resolve the problem where it took place and was silenced for so long? We need an objective person to help clear the dysfunction. It is our responsibility as a community to help every child, whether they are being abused by a relative, an acquaintance, or a stranger. But the more vulnerable the child, the more help they will need. As I stand for today, I wish I could tell you it gets better, but it doesn't. Child sexual abuse will always be devastating. It will always be painful, and it should be. But you will get better, and you will learn to cope with the pain and devastation, and you will be able to lead a healthy life because you can get better. I promise. But it's time to end this. Please, I beg you, be aware of what is happening in your home. It can be happening in any home. Speak to your children. Educate them. If any one of your precious children comes to you and discloses abuse by another family member, tell them you believe them. You will never have another chance to make that lasting first impression and then help them. You can help both the abuser and the victim and love them both.
Now here is Mitty Weiss. For many years, his father was a mechanech, a rebbe in Telz. He was molested in yeshiva by one of the older, a mechanech in the yeshiva. Listen to what he says when he's asked, why didn't you speak up, or did you speak up? It's not just a female thing.
When I was younger, as you mentioned, I grew up, my father was a rebbe in Telz Yeshiva in Chicago, and I was just one of those kids that, I didn't quite fit into the system, perhaps. Not a bad kid in any way. It just sometimes you have kids who just have a little trouble fitting into the system. And this was a very disturbing thing to my father. And so as a result, I think throughout the years, he just went to different people to try to figure out how to sort of set me straight, I guess. And unfortunately, what that did is had me end up over by Avremel Mandarovitz, who was actually a family friend. We all, you know, he grew up in Chicago. He was a Talmud in the yeshiva by my father, and certainly was a very familiar person, and had a reputation for, you know, helping out kids in that situation. And so I had the privilege of going and spending some time with him over summer, and that's where I ended up. And you know, of course, a very charming and charismatic person. He, you know, showed me the greatest time when I was in New York. Very fun. He gave me a ton of attention. I thought it was a tremendous experience. I, you know, soaked up every moment of it. And, you know, of course, it's all a Hamish's situation. So, you know, a familiar person to my father. And so, of course, it was no problem. I'd stay over at their house, etc. He had, of course, a large family. But what he neglected to tell my father, my parents, is that his entire family was up in a bungalow colony, and it was actually just me and him. And so, as a result, I found myself as a, you know, somewhat vulnerable young kid who's getting tremendously positive attention, but ultimately for the wrong reasons. And so when it was just me and him, he basically charmed and manipulated and groomed his way into earning my trust, and so therefore, unfortunately, put me in positions where ultimately I was molested by him. All those statistics, they are 100% true. That are good, decent people, Balei Chesed, Balei Tzedakah, they'll do anything for anybody. Suddenly something comes up and one of their kids are harmed, and, you know, all of a sudden all bets are off, and, you know, the they suddenly, instead of doing the right thing by their child and, you know, going to the authorities and getting the kid the right support and whatever, you know, of course it always ties into the whole shidduch situation because everybody's trying to protect their, you know, pedigree and, you know, pristine reputation and, you know, whatever. So as a result, otherwise good, decent, smart, you know, God-fearing people suddenly go off the rails and they won't say anything. And in doing so, they completely sacrifice another one of their children to the Molech.
Terrible.
Now listen to this young woman from Australia. Listen to her story. We have on the phone with us from Melbourne, Australia, Dasi Erlach, who has a poignant and powerful story to share with us. And rather than me getting into it, let's hear from Dasi herself. Welcome, Dasi.
Hi, David. Thank you for having me.
So let me ask you, Dasi, tell us a little bit about your story. You know, here in America, there have been, according to Tzvi Gluck, over 100 suicides in the last year. And he says a substantial amount of them were children who were abused who were not able to deal with it. And I think your story is powerful on terrible. That means 100 families that are sitting shiva, and siblings and uncles and aunts. And it just, it can wreck a family. I mean, I know families like this. Many parents never recover. And I think your story is powerful, both as something we should be aware of, and also maybe at the end you'll share with us how you were able to overcome such an attack, an egregious attack on yourself. So, Dasi, why don't you share with us your story?
I'll just share with you the main parts of my story, which I grew up in an ultra-Orthodox community here in Melbourne, a very small, closed community, so quite exclusive, not really connected to any of the wider Jewish communities here in Melbourne. So everything in the, everyone knew everyone else in the community. Everyone went to the same school. Everyone looked up to the same rabbis. Everyone was pretty much related to everyone else. So it was a very small, exclusive community. And I went to this school where I was, you know, taught obviously a lot of religious studies. there wasn't a very big focus on knowing anything outside of that. So what we were taught at the school, that was our world. And obviously the focus was a lot on the religious studies. We weren't really taught much, like the general curriculum was at a very low level. So I grew up in that school, I had friends, I enjoyed school. I didn't know anything about, you know, the body, about my sexual identity, absolutely nothing. That's not something that you ever speak about, think about, know, or should know about. And when I was about 14 years old, Malkalifa entered the school, and she became principal very quickly of the school. And she was a very charming, very charismatic person. She was extremely friendly. Everyone looked up to her. The entire community looked up to her. Everyone, you know, thought that she was special. She was someone that everyone kind of wanted to know and have something to do with. She lent some sort of status to the community because she was that type of person that everyone looked up to. And she became the principal of the school. And while she was the principal of the school, she got to know her students, and she would single out certain students to be her favorites. And of course, as the principal of the school, everyone wanted to be her favorite. So she would, as they say, the grooming period, she would get to know students, she would invite them over to her house, invite them over to come and have special study sessions with her. And she did that with me, and over the years she grew me to just accept what she was doing as normal. And she sexually abused me and quite a few other people that I know, including my sisters. And I had absolutely no words for what was happening for me. I didn't understand what was happening. I had no words for what was happening to me. There was no one I could actually talk to. She was seen as, you know, someone that was the head of, in a way, the head of the community. So trying to speak out against her was something that I couldn't even think about doing, even if I had had the words. But I didn't have the words. I didn't have absolutely any language. I didn't understand what was happening. So I left school and got...
But, Darcy, why didn't you speak to your parents?
So my parents, so I came from a home that was abusive, and I think that's why Malkalifa was able to kind of really draw me in with her warmth and her love, because she knew that I wasn't getting that at home. And so she knew that there was a, you know, big lack of communication between myself and my parents, and there was a lot of, you know, other type of abuse going on there. And so I wasn't close to my parents, and my siblings weren't either. So I think that's something that she knew that we were vulnerable with, and that's how she kind of used that situation to draw us in.
When did you realize something is wrong?
So as I got a little bit older, I understood that it became very uncomfortable. I knew that something was wrong, but I didn't understand what was really wrong. But I started hiding from her and not wanting to see her, but she would send other students to come and find me. And obviously, by me hiding from her, there was some acknowledgement that what was happening was just not right. But I had no way to stop what was happening.
And how long did it go on for?
It went on until I left the school, got married, and went to live in Israel for a few years.
Tell me about your story. You got married. Like, what damage did it do?
So I was completely, as they say, disassociated. So I was completely cut off. The way that I managed to kind of get on with life was completely to disassociate from my feelings. So I just kind of was completely numb inside. And it obviously led to a lot of stress in our marriage. I was trying to get pregnant with my husband. We were living in Israel. I became quite depressed. I wasn't able to get pregnant, and that was also something that was playing on my mind, because that's what I was taught growing up, that that was my identity as a Jewish woman, to obviously to have a child, to have children. And I wasn't able to do that. I became quite depressed. I started seeing a therapist, and I started talking to her about the things, you know, that I was thinking about. And at some point in that therapy, she said to me, you know, something doesn't make sense here. The, what you're explaining to me, how you're feeling and the way that you're cut off from your emotions, there's some trauma that has happened to you that you're not telling me. And over time, I did tell her, and I disclosed to her about what had happened. And she was actually a social worker in Israel who had come from Australia. So she actually knew Mal Khalifa, and she had worked with Mal Khalifa, and I knew that. And she didn't quite believe me, because obviously she knew Mal Khalifa, and she respected her a lot. And so she kind of looked at me like, really? That's, you know, so I said, well, why don't you call up, you know, my sister, and call up, you know, some other girls, because I know that they'd been in the same position as me. So she did, and she called up someone at the school, and then that person ended up going to Mal Khalifa and confronting her, and Mal Khalifa said, oh, no, you know, don't worry, like, you know, I've dealt with this already, I've spoken to, I think it was the Vad HaChinuch, you know, I've spoken to them, and we've dealt with this situation, you know, you don't have to worry about it. And eventually, this was when a couple more girls came out, this situation was taken to the school board, and they confronted her again, and she said, you know, I'm going to resign, and I'm going to, they asked her to stand down, and then they actually paid for her ticket to leave that night to Israel. I came back to Australia, and I went through some fertility treatments, and I gave birth to my daughter. And I looked at my daughter, and when I gave birth to her, I looked at her, and I knew cognitively I could love, like, I loved her, but emotionally I couldn't feel anything, and it scared me so much that there was nothing there. Like, I couldn't, there was no emotion. And I realized that I was, you know, I had to do something. So, you know, I went home, and I went back to therapy, and when she was about 7 months old, I was struggling with my religion at that point as well. When she was about 7 months old, I went into a mother and baby psychiatric clinic with her for a couple of months. And there I was able to learn to bond with her and get the help that I needed. But through that time, obviously, I was struggling with religion, and I was really struggling with bringing up my daughter in a community that had hurt me so much. And I knew also by going to the police, because during that time I went to the police to give my statement, I wasn't able to be a part of that community anymore. And I got divorced from my husband. I went in and out of hospital for a year, and I was able to get the therapy that I needed and have the support systems in place to help me. And then my husband decided that he didn't want me to have anything to do with my daughter, so we went through the custody courts. And I think going through the custody courts and having to prove that I was a good mother to my daughter really, really pushed me to do the best that I could in order to heal and to go to therapy and look at how I can be a good mother. And so it was a long journey, and it's still something that I'm working on. It's not something that I'm ever going to stop working on. It's something that I'm going to have to continuously work on. And it's a journey. It's a process.
And before Mal Khalifa came into your life, Shem Rishayim Yerkov, were you just a regular girl? Like, was this all the damage of this monster?
So obviously, it's like I said, I came from an abusive home. So it was, you know, those were, that kind of laid the groundwork for me to be a lot more vulnerable to Mal Khalifa. But I think a lot of the, like, I'm very close to my siblings. I have six siblings, and I'm very close to all of them, and we're all really, really close. And they've always, you know, stood beside me and been there for me. And I think with Mal Khalifa, I think it's the whole fact of the way that she drew me and told me that she loved me, and, you know, try to teach me that that was what love meant, has really had an effect on my life more than anything else.
And it seems that when this happens, when a child is 14, it's hard to get these demons out, no?
I think when it happens at any age, it's hard to get past it. And it really also depends on having the people around you that are able to help you through that and that can support you through that. And knowing that you can be open with them about what you're going through, that's a huge part of, you know, of being able to process and heal and move on.
And I take it that the community that you were part of did not support you.
There was a lot of gossip going around the community. Everyone knew that I was the person that had kind of had disclosed what I had disclosed in therapy and had set stuff in motion. And there was the whole concept of let's not talk about it, but there was a lot of gossip going on. And also there's the whole idea in the community, and I know this is a worldwide, you know, issue, that when it comes to shidduchim, you know, if you've got something in your family, then you're kind of looked as damaged goods. And I knew, you know, having my daughter in that community and growing up, because of my actions, she would be seen as damaged goods. And I didn't ever want anyone to look at my daughter in that way. And I mean, that's a whole different issue altogether. But the community, for the most part, has not been supportive. There has been several people that have reached out over the years from the community that I've really, really appreciated. But for the most part, it's just silence. There's just silence, which is which can be really horrible.
When you were a child at 14, do you feel other people should have noticed changes in you? Like, were there silent cries that were unheard?
In the school, and because no one had dealt with this before, like the school had no idea, there were so many signs about what was happening that people, you know, in retrospect said, oh, we should have understood, you know, that she was taking people into, you know, her office and closing all the blinds and closing the doors and having people sleeping over at her house. I mean, that's just not normal behavior, but no one had dealt with that, something like that before. So there was a lot of signs, you know. I did, like my grades did slip, you know, during the last few years of my school, and I was more distracted. I don't know if, you know, unless people understand those signs, that they would have known that's what to look for. I think the education now is a lot better because people understand that's what to look for. But during that time, you know, no one had ever dealt with something like that before. So they kind of had no idea what to even look for.
Now, when you say your grade slipped, like, were you a good student before this?
I was always a good student. I always got top marks. And I still did continue in some subjects to get, you know, top marks. But, yeah, my grades did slip in some subjects when I just wasn't able to concentrate.
Were there any other signs that you exhibited, silent signs? Was there any weight loss? Was there any other physical things that a neighbor should have noticed or a friend should have noticed?
Again, I think with education, these signs are becoming more common. But back then, I don't think there was something extremely obvious, except for the behavior of Malkalifa that, you know, would not pass in today's day and age. But there wasn't, you know, listen, if there was someone there in the school that would have noticed that, you know, I was a little bit more withdrawn or I was, you know, a little bit more distracted and would have pulled me aside and said, hey, you know, what's going on? Maybe that could have opened up some way of me being able to talk about what was going on. But there wasn't. There wasn't. That didn't exist.
And could you share with us what were some of your darkest moments going through this?
Well, during the actual time that the abuse was going on, I think it was just this, I was living a double life. There was what was happening, and then there was, you know, the rest of my life, and I was completely disassociated between the two. It led to a lot of conflict within myself, and then trying to bury that conflict and trying to, you know, just completely numb my feelings so that I didn't, because I didn't understand what was going on. And then post that, you know, I went through a time that I was quite suicidal when I was in hospital. I was self-harming. I wasn't able to bond emotionally with my daughter. I would say that would probably be the darkest times.
When you were suicidal.
The most challenging times.
Why do you think you were able to get past it, whereas we have so many teenagers and young people who just can't get past it and do commit suicide or do overdose?
I think the main two things that I can say that really helped me to move past it was, A, having a support system in place, my siblings and other various family members that were there to support me and just let me know that they were there for me, you know, come and visit me in hospital and just, you know, be there, not even in huge ways, just by constantly knowing that that they were there for me, and if I needed them, that they were around me. And the other thing I think that really helped me to get better was having a reason to get better. You know, it's very hard to get out of that cycle of what I call the cycle of a victim. It's very hard to kind of step out of that cycle and tell yourself you can get better, you can move on. And there are ways to process this. It's extremely hard when you're in that cycle to step out of it. And I think having to fight for my daughter and having a reason to get better and looking at her and knowing that I wanted to be a good mother to her, that gave me an immense push to try and heal myself and figure out what can I do to take care of myself and to be a good mom to her.
What would you say to the people who supported Malkalifa and smuggled her out of the country? What would you say to them? If they're listening now, what would you say to these people?
I actually don't really have any words to say to those people. I would hope that they understand what they've done and, you know, I actually don't have any words to say to those people. I just don't.
And what would you say to Malkalifa if she was listening tonight?
I would say that she should stop playing the system in Israel and just come and, stop prolonging the trauma, because that's what she's doing by playing the system like she is in Israel and not wanting to face extradition courts and therefore is unable to be extradited back to Australia to face the 74 charges that she has in Australia. She's just prolonging the trauma, not just for myself, but for all the other people that have been traumatized by her and that are just waiting to face her in court. And she's just prolonging that trauma.
What would you say to children who were molested or teens that were molested who are listening tonight? What would you tell them?
That's a really tough one. I think I'll just tell them to, you know, reach out to the people around them that are hopefully there to support them, that they need a good support system in place, that they've been through something and they should be kind to themselves and accept that they've been through something and understand that it's going to take time to heal. And I think being kind to themselves and not kind of criticizing and judging themselves for not being able to move on as quickly as people around them may want them to move on. I think that's a big thing. And just that I'm sorry for their pain. I'm really, really sorry for their pain. And I really hope that they are able to heal and lead a fulfilling life.
Darcy, thank you for sharing your story. And I hope that the children listening will reach out to somebody to support them and look at you and say, Darcy survived it and I can too.
Yeah. Thank you, David.
Thank you so much. Frightening story. Where were we? Why didn't we notice when children cringe, when children change? You know, I don't know if you were struck with, but I was. There's a certain detachedness from when she talks about pretty hideous things that happened to her at the age of 14. But it's like this control type of voice. I thought she would cry and scream and yell. And I remembered You know, the Mechaber in Kuf Lamed Aleph, in Hilchas Nesias Kapayim, Hilchas Nefilas Kapayim, says that, in Hilchas Tachnan, in other words, Shulchan Aruch says that in the base of Avol, you don't say Tachnan. And my wife is like quite a famous coach and, you know, psychologist. Or when I asked her, Shifri, why don't you cry in a beis avol? And she said to me, because they were afraid that if an avol starts crying, they put their head down and they cry, maybe they'll never stop crying. And when you hear this young woman and you hear the detachedness, it's like, you know how they deal with it, many of them? They become sort of detached from their emotions. Takes years of therapy to bring it back together, to be ma'acha the kragen, because if they start crying, they're afraid maybe they'll never stop crying. Now, you want to know the damage that this does? Listen to Dr. Berkowitz, Dr. Shira Berkowitz, one of the experts on molestation. Listen to her tell us risks. We had three people who didn't commit suicide on, but They may be uncommon. We had this year 130-some-odd suicides. Listen to her speak about what the risk is.
I will say that the risk of suicide goes up significantly for a child who has been abused, along with a lot of other potential adverse consequences, such as all sorts of things like alcohol dependency, depression, anxiety, and even health-related risks that we would never think about, such as heart disease, liver disease, cancer, dying younger. All of these things have been found. All children who have been abused even one time have been found to be at increased risk for these adverse outcomes.
Now, here is David Framowitz. He was molested by Coco, he says, like 35 or 40 years ago. And listen 40 years later what pain that which he speaks about it. You want to know the damage that this does. This is from a survivor, somebody who did not commit suicide.
Did you tell them, anybody in the yeshiva?
I did not tell anybody in the yeshiva.
Can you, David, how has this affected you in your life? To tell you that I admire the courage that it takes for you to come on, and the reason I ask you is because hopefully we do have thousands and thousands of parents listening, and it's important that they know that when their child comes over to them, that they should believe it and understand the impact of it. So if you don't, and if any time you feel uncomfortable, just say, let's move to another. How has that affected you in your life?
How that affected me? Look, we're talking about something that occurred when I was 11 years old. That's 47 years ago.
So David, if Yuri Coco is listening, what would you tell them?
He should rot in hell. He should be ashamed of going to shul. He should not be given an aliyah in any shul. He should not be given any kavod. The guy is a lowlife. He ruined dozens and dozens of boys. I've met with dozens of victims of Yuri Coco over the past 10 years. I met someone who was in the Mir Yeshiva before he even came to Tarv Tamima, Tarv Adasa Flappish. Coco was a dorm counselor or something had to do with the dorm. And the guy told me that he was molested in the dorms in the dorms of Mir. Okay, Coco's been doing this for decades.
I want to conclude. Here is Reb David Cohn. And in my eyes, Reb David Cohn is the Pesach of America. And even though there are Paiskim who could disagree in Eretz Yisrael, etc., we say Ein lechach chacham ela shebiya novi asher biyamecha. And the Mishneh Berurah, the Shaar HaTzion, and Hilchos Yom Kippur brings from Rabbeinu Menoach, it's not just on a chronological age the novi asher biyamecha, but it's on a geographical level. and you're going to say, you see Reb David Cohen says, he says, the Rabbanim who don't agree or didn't paskin this way, they just don't know the damage. Could be an out years ago. Maybe it didn't shame so much. Maybe children today are more sensitive. But this is the Navi Hashem Yamecha. Listen to the psak of Reb David Cohen.
It's a beferish din a shulchan aruch, black and white. Mitzar hatzibu, you give him over to the authorities not to kill him. Lani yistati, we have no right bisman hazeh to be ma'anish someone. My opinion is that anyone who's guilty of molestation, that's guilty by umdina, and incidentally there's a ramah that. Ketanim, takonas hagoinim, that ketanim anemon.
As on Nashim, the Ramah, Nashim, where there's no Nashim nimtza.
Right, that's
the two of the Shailom Eshev on that. Yeah.
But it's Ramah. So right. I'm not saying, the Ramah goes for Gabi Hilchus Seidus. By us, Umdene is enough. If the Umdene is that what these children are saying is true, according to the Umdene, we have to not punish. We're not allowed to punish. But we have to be matzil hatzibur. So I believe that every molester should be given a life sentence. I believe that those rabbonim that were always very lax and were against paskening, that a matzar hatzibur should be given over to the authorities, it's simply because they didn't know what molestation meant. Can't justify what they did in any way if they would really know what a molestation does. That knowing what we know today, it's pasha that you go to the authorities. Rabbonim are not trained like psychologists. Even among psychologists, one needs special training in this area called molestation. So they, before when they have a case against the person, there is consultation. The person is giving a fair chance to defend himself. But certainly, we have to give these a mitzari at zebra. This is the way we have to react. And why we are obligated to do so. And a person who doesn't do so is over an avera called leisamer al dam reyecha. There's no doubt in my mind.
You know, the sources that Reb David Cohen is bringing, he's bringing the Shulchan Aruch in Shin Peches, right? Where the Shulchan Aruch brings that somebody who's a Meitzer Arabim, Kol HaMeitzre HaTzibur Mitzaron Mutal LeMoisran B'Yad Akum, right? LaKoysoy LaAsrei LaKansoy. It's Shin Peches Simit Sivkot and Yud Beis. As always, by the way, the Maramakoymas are on our website. You know, if you click on it, there's a log that says Mara Makoimis. We also put the comments on as well, right? Now, additionally, it's a Maracha or Zeruah and Shuvah, it says the same thing. And as far as accepting the testimony of a Katan, right, the Shulchan Aruch in Chayshim Mishpat, Lamed HaYudalad, says even if somebody that's Pasal Edis, in a situation where it's not common to find valid witnesses, they are allowed to testify. Right? And that's why women, it says we are in an area where men is, or a minor is not, wouldn't be, there wouldn't be, like in a place of a mikveh where there would be no men. In such a case, a woman would be allowed to testify. And if you look at the Shailum Eshev in Madura Kama, Simon Kuf Pei Hei, he talks about being Maimon Ketanim, you could accept the testimony, the edus of a katan, in a case of molestation. That's a psak of Shailom Eshev. So these are the Makairis that Reb David Cohen brings. Again, he says it has a din of a Meitzer Avim. And just to paraphrase it, which is really what the Marimi Riesenberg, says, which is also a Marshal, and we'll post all these. If you see somebody running after somebody with a knife, do you call the Rav or do you call the policeman? A molester. They say molesters never molest one child. When you have a molester who's running around, it's the equivalent of somebody running with a knife. He's a Meitzer Harabim. And the Marshal says very clearly, anybody can give him over to the police. Anybody could beat him personally. He says you do not have to go to a Rav. You do not have to go to a Bezdin. The Psak of the Marshal will post the Maramakayim to this online. So what's my ending? Aval Hashemim Anachnu. This Yom Kippur, we have to do tshuva. What do we have to do tshuva for? If there's over 100 suicides in our community and we've done nothing, we've looked the other way, we haven't come out in mass and said, this has to stop, we have to do tshuva for this. And even if we didn't see it exactly, we should have heard the cry of the silent. And I'm convinced, I am sure, that the Rabbeinu Shlomo is Mida Keneged Mida. If we are able to hear the silent cry, certainly Kavayachal, the Rabbeinu Shlomo, and we protect those children, and we can cut the suicide, and we give over the molesters, we give them over to the police, who will do their investigations and deal with them in an appropriate manner. But if we can hear that silent cry, the schus that we heard the silent cry, the Rabbeinu Shalom will hear our silent cry, and it would be Yiyu L'Ratzein Imrei Fi and Hegyein Libi Lefanecha. We should all be zeicha to a good Gebenshtyar. This is David Lichtenstein for Headlines Radio.